says it's the end of time. And the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Hey, 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 welcome to Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine. Hey, Colorado, how's it going today?
Good, man, good. It's been a pretty crazy week, but we're still rocking and rolling over here.
Yeah, we're freezing our butts off up here. Right now.
You know what? Well, I was going to say I'm not going to rub it in, but I'm going to rub it in. There is no snow out on the ground, and I walked to the mailbox in my flip-flops here in Colorado this morning.
That is ridiculous. Nothing else to say about it other than ridiculous. We, I was in Michigan earlier this week, and when I was up there, we were in the 20s, and the first night we got 4 inches of snow, and then the next morning we got 3 inches, and then when I left, they were in the process of getting three more. And I got home, and we were negative 11 degrees. Without the wind chill, and I had 3 feet of snow outside. Now it stopped snowing, and I think it warmed up to probably zero today. But yeah, that's the way we're rolling right now.
Nice. Not.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I actually had a chicken freeze to death.
Oh no!
Yeah, that's my first chicken loss. I mean, well. My first chicken loss with the new chickens.
With the new chickens.
Yeah, I had my fox chicken loss, but
right.
Yeah, but the girls were devastated. They got all the chickens got up into the coop, early, and I guess this one went underneath, and the big windstorm came up last night, and chicken was not smart enough to run back out and run back up inside there, so she got caught when the wind was blowing 40 miles an hour and it got to like 12 below with the wind chill. And I went out there and she was just barely moving, and I picked her up and put her inside the coop, and within 7 minutes she passed. She just died. It was just way too cold for her to be out in the air. So that sucked.
Yeah.
So I had frozen chicken.
Frozen chicken. Hey, man, I can get that at the store.
Yeah, no kidding. Unfortunately, she was one of my better layers, so I'm kind of sad about it. But you know, that's life, I guess. Life on a farm.
Yep.
So, how's everything else going? I mean, I know that you've been getting speakers together for the show coming up, and all kinds of things.
Yep, getting speakers. I'd like to announce our title sponsor. We got a title sponsor. Daily Bread is our title sponsor for the Self-Reliance Expo 2013. I was just out in Utah with that, and you remember hearing about that with the security, airport security, and dealing with all that nonsense. And then honestly, this week, the last couple of days, I've just been concentrating on finding a road vehicle because I'm not flying anymore. So,
well, let's take a step back. I did hear about the TSA escapades via Facebook.
Yeah.
Why don't you take a few minutes and tell the audience, and just to kind of give a little bit of background, Colorado Ron has a reoccurring theme with TSA. So I'm surprised he's not on a no-fly list. But go ahead. Tell us what happened.
Well, I went through security, and I had my Berkey filter in my bag, my Berkey Sport water bottle. And there was about an inch of water in the bottom of it, and I forgot to dump it out before I walked into the airport. Anyway, I went through security, and the guy said he pulls it out of my bag and said, you can't go through security with this. And I said, oh, really? And I said, well, it's got a little bit of water. I saw a trash can sitting next to him. I said, you know, here I am. You got to remember now, everybody knows you're putting your shoes on. I'm sitting there trying to hop on one foot, putting my belt on, trying to grab all my laptop and all my other junk that's all over the place that they make you take off. And I said, just dump it out in the trash can there. And he says, I can't. He says, you have to take it back out and run it through security again. I said, you're telling me I have to go all the way back out and go through the line? He goes, yep, and turned away. That's when I got mad, is because he just completely just brushed me off. And then I looked over, and this lady was running this another what looked like a water bottle through a machine to make sure that it was safe, and then it went on. And so I said, hey, why can't I run in mine through there? And they said, oh, that's for babies, for, like, you know, they have juice and baby formula and stuff like that. And I said, whatever. I said, well, fine, hand me the bottle and I'll dump the water out. And he says, you can't do that. You still got to go through security, and you got to dump the water out on the other side of security. And I said, this is ridiculous. No wonder nobody likes you guys. And he goes, excuse me? And I said, yeah, you guys have no common sense. And I said, this is ridiculous. I said, if you can't tell the difference between water and explosive liquid, then you shouldn't be working security anyway. And I snatched the bottle out of his hand and was grabbing my stuff. And he says, hold on a second. So the supervisor comes over. And he filled the supervisor in on what had happened. And I said, it's really frustrating. And he says, well, I'll tell you what. If you could do something different with TSA, what would you do? You know, I looked at him like, are you serious? You're seriously asking me this? And so I answered him. I said, I'd disband you and fire every one of you. And that's when they took me into a little room and had me sit there, basically. And all he wanted to do was sit in there and argue with me, is what he wanted to do. And so I stood up. I got mad. I stood up, and I walked across the room, and I says, look, there, there, and there. I said, there's three security holes I see in your security right now. You're sitting in here eating a freaking burrito and telling me about how I need the TSA, and here I can see three holes in your security right here from this window. And anyway, he got mad and walked out. And about 5 minutes before my plane was supposed to take off, he came back in and let me go, and then as soon as I got to the gate where I was supposed to get on the plane, I was the last one there. And there happened to be a TSA guard sitting there and said that they were doing random pat searches, and pat searched me down again one more time before I got on the plane.
You know, it's kind of funny. The searches have gotten really, really ridiculous. The last one that I went on, the last flight that I went on, I went through TSA, and I purposely didn't buy my water. I typically buy it at a gas station when I'm filling up before I get there and leave my parked car, and because I knew I wasn't going to down the whole thing prior to me getting through security. So I get through security, and they already had a problem because I was traveling with three laptops last week, and they seem to get all bent when you have like a ton of electronics. And they were like, "Well, you have a lot of electronics in here," and I go, "Yep." And they were like, well, do you necessarily need that many electronics? Like, what does that have to do with anything?
Exactly. Who are you? Why are you?
And,
exactly.
And so I said, I hate taking up this many bins. If you'd let me stack them on top of each other, I would. But, I had like eight bins. I felt horrible for the people behind me. And when I went to the other side, I felt like I got targeted because as I after I got through the line, I walked over to the internal store and I bought a bottle of water. And the TSA guard was watching me. So he looked me right in the eye as I opened up my water bottle and walked away. And I'm sure he was probably thinking, that jerk, because I talked back to him.
Mm-hmm.
So when my flight took off and they said, okay, flight such and such is boarding for New York, they walk up to the door and they said they're going to be randomly testing liquids. I'm like, I've never heard of this before. What the hell are they talking about? So he walks up to me and says, we need to test your water bottle. And I said, what? And he goes, we need to test your water bottle. And I said, for what? And they said, well, for, illegal materials. And I was like, I looked right at the guy because it was the same guard. And I said, you stared right at me when when I bought it and I cracked it open. And he was just like, I'm a well-traveled person, so I usually get to board first. And so he's like, well, would you like to board with your time, or would you rather stand here and have a conversation? And I was kind of like, fine, test the water bottle. Matter of fact, I go, they're boarding mine now, keep the water bottle. And I just gave it to him and walked off, and like, if they're going to test it, go ahead and test it. Throw it away when you're done.
I would have said, yeah, well, if you're thirsty, why don't you just say so? Here, have it.
I don't get it. You know, I don't get where, you know, first of all, they don't have any real legal authority. I mean, they haven't been trained as police officers. They have, you know, they're security guards. And from what I understand, unfortunately, and if there's any TSA people out here that want to contradict me, you guys can hit me up on Facebook. You know, most of these guys, you know, you don't even have to have a college education or much of a education level whatsoever.
No, it's very low paying. It's very low paying. Here's the frustrating part: is it's low paying. The guy that I was dealing with, like I said, wanted to argue with me to the point that a normal person that argues like that, I just smack them, you know. But now I'd be smacking a federal officer, you know, and I'm a federal employee. Now you're talking about a whole nother level of problems.
Well, hold on. Is TSA actually a federal employee? I thought it was a privately held company that.
Oh, maybe you're right. I thought they were federal.
I don't believe so. I believe TSA is an independent company that is a contractor of the government.
Oh, you shouldn't have told me that. I would have smacked him.
No, I'll have to look. But see, that's the problem. Is, you know, when you watch it, they have a cop and they have some sort of federal officers on site that when you mess with them, they automatically turn you over to the others, and then you get in trouble anyway. So.
Yeah, and I saw the cop there, and he was watching me. Anyway, it was so stupid. And then the fact that they pat me down, and then I had, the other flight, they were doing random pat searches at the gate as well. And a woman was there, and she was just picking out like every other woman in the crowd and pat searching them down. And every woman in the line was so upset because they just felt so violated. And I'm like, why am I paying to travel this way? You know, honestly, you know, I when I flew out there, I had a 2-hour delay. We had to change planes, had a 2-hour delay. Okay? So the flight to Salt Lake from Denver is 2 hours. Okay? Salt Lake to Denver is 2 hours. 2-hour delay. Now we're up to 4 hours. Then I have to get a rental car and deal with all that nonsense and get checked out there and all that. So that's another hour. So now we're 5 hours. And I can drive to Salt Lake in 7 hours.
Yeah.
So you know, the only time it makes sense is when it's really long, but that doesn't even, you know, that doesn't count for TSA and all the other nonsense. So, you know, honestly, I'm just driving from now on. I'm sick of it. You know, I got to go wrap up some details in Arlington here in a couple of weeks, and I'm just driving. I'm just not going to fly anymore. You know, last time we flew to Arlington, we got 13 tornadoes, and I was stuck there for a week. So I might as well just drive.
Well, that's true. That's very true. Huh. Well, so tell us how you really feel about TSA.
Oh, piss me. And don't get me started on them guys. So anyway, yeah, I am no fan of TSA. I'm no fan of security at the airport like that. It's just really frustrating. So basically, obviously we know about Project Haas. You know, that's my big crew cab. But I can't drive that long distances, and so I'm looking for something a little bit more gas friendly, a little bit more undercover, I guess. You know, that doesn't stand out, and just kind of something that gets like 20 miles to the gallon. So I've just been looking at different vehicles and trying to figure out what would be a good road trip car for, you know, four adults and their luggage.
Okay, well. Let's touch base with that after we talk with Charles, because I'm actually looking at a new car, and I got to tell you my new car story here in a few minutes. So starting this week, folks, we are going to be doing, you know, and I think part of this happened because I'm having I'm having cabin fever. You know, we haven't had a, and the funny thing is, Colorado, it hasn't been a harsh winter. We haven't had a lot of snow. You know, but both of our snowstorms have been like this, where it's like 4 or 5 days, it blows like crazy, like 40, 50 miles an hour winds. You know, we get 7, 8 foot drifts, and then for the next week, it's below zero. And then it gets back up to 30, 31, which is, you know, it's still below freezing, but mild. But it takes you like 3 weeks to kind of dig yourself out of the drifts. You know, I and everybody's like, oh, this is so unusual. It's like, well, doesn't that figure? Because it's like, you know, usually you get gentle snows and they're just pretty consistent and it's no big deal and you can drive in it. And it's like, well, we got, you know, half an inch of ice on the road right now. Got to go out there with a freaking jackhammer. So, yeah, but anyway, so because of that, you know, we were talking and we want to get started with, you know, getting prepared for spring. You know, because a lot of people believe that, you know, spring gets here and then they get overwhelmed and they never get all their stuff done. I'm a perfect classic case of that. And what ends up happening is we never get everything done. And so, you know, we're going to bring on some experts like Charles Sanders and Jackie Clay and Marjorie Wildcraft to talk about the things they do as we're at the tail end of winter here, I hope, and to get prepared ahead of time.
Nice.
So we should take our quick first commercial break, and then when we come back, we'll try giving Charles a quick call. How's that sound?
Yeah.
All right, guys, so we'll be back with you right after this commercial.
If everything you eat comes out of boxes stored in your freezer, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo. If you're afraid to take out your own garbage because the neighbor kids might beat you up, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
Over 50 training classes are coming to the Self-Reliance Expo. This family-friendly event focuses on traditional values and long-forgotten skills. Gardening, alternative home building, off-grid living, food preservation, cooking with the sun, self-defense classes, canine demos, and more.
If you can kill a houseplant just by looking at it, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
The Self-Reliance Expo is fun for the whole family and is the largest of its kind in the nation. Learn how to do it yourself. Learn how to defend yourself. Save money. Save a life.
If the only screwdriver you own is made of orange juice and vodka, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
It's the Self-Reliance Expo, coming soon. Find out more by going to SelfRelianceExpo.com. That's SelfRelianceExpo.com.
All right, guys, you are back with Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine. All right, Colorado, let's give Charles here a call. Now, Charles has been on the show several times. While I'm prepping this up, let's talk a little bit about Charles. I'm trying to remember, and maybe you usually have a better memory than I do, what was the last conversation we had with Charles? Do you remember?
Oh, wow. My last conversation was rescheduling rescheduling the radio interview.
Right. That doesn't count, though.
No, you know, I don't remember. We've talked to so many people.
Well, okay. So Charles writes a lot of different articles. You know, he's done like build your own cart, you know, raising your own beef for the family, you know, using PVC in the home and garden. How to build your own fence. I'm trying to think, you know.
A lot of common man type projects. I really like it. A lot of hands-on common man type projects.
Yeah, and he likes doing a lot of tips and tricks and things like that. I think the last one time we talked to him, we spent a lot of time talking to him about bee basics.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, Charles is also the he's like the
Went in the Department of Wildlife or something like that. He works. Yeah.
So
I do remember that now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that it'll be interesting hearing the types of things that that Charles does to get prepared for something like this.
Yeah.
All right. So let's give him a call. and we'll see what kind of rabbit holes we can get, you know, get caught up in with Charles. So, all right, here we go.
I hear the ringing.
Hello.
Hey, Charles, this is Bubba Da Vinci in Colorado, Ron. How are you doing today?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
We're doing fine. Thanks for joining the show.
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I mean, we had to make sure, especially with all the lightning strikes and everything else that we've had going on here, we wanted to make sure that we got this completed.
Right. Well, I appreciate it. It's taken us a little while to do it, but I'm glad that we are.
So, in our email, Charles, we kind of told you the direction we're going to be trying to go this next couple of weeks, which is, you know, things that people can do to get prepared for all their spring activities as preppers, you don't have to wait on, you know, tips and tricks and things like that, and things that you do to get prepared for spring. Can you share some of your ideas with us?
Oh yeah, I'd be happy to. There's a lot going on this time of year. Of course, here in despite the weather today here in southern Indiana, spring's kind of right around the corner. We've had some warm days and a lot of real cold days, but you can see the buds starting to swell on some of the fruiting plants, like the blueberry bushes and things, and it just reminds you that springtime is right around the corner, and there are things to be done. Very soon here, coming up into February now, there's pruning to do. We can talk about that a little bit. There's spraying, some early spraying that can be done on the fruit trees and things, and that's something that we need to start planning.
Let's start off with the pruning. So I have a question. And this is something I just learned recently. And I was out there and I was in their yard and someone was asking me if I was going to be pruning the trees up, and I was just like, I didn't understand. And they were saying you should always prune your trees, you know, really late fall going into winter or before spring happens when it's still cold. And for some reason that seems counterproductive. What would be the reason for doing your pruning now as opposed to, you know, in the spring?
Well, for one reason is the sap is down, and you won't get a lot of bleeding around the, you know, at the scar or at the cut. And obviously the insects are not present to immediately start attacking the raw tree stem or where you cut. So that's a couple of advantages right there. And it allows you to see the tree without the leaves, so you can kind of see the shape and some of the limbs that need to be taken out, which is a lot of what you're doing when you're pruning a fruit tree is you're basically shaping it. You're getting a good shape that will help it to withstand weather. You're getting the limbs growing in the right places, removing the poorly placed ones, and things like that.
Now, does that cause any issues with the tree bearing fruit the next year? I mean, I know it sounds silly, but you would think that doing something like that would almost like put the tree into shock. I mean,
No. In fact, it's the opposite. If it helps to really increase the fruit production, if you do the pruning, allows the tree to concentrate on the fruiting instead of. I saw somewhere here just the other day where if you don't prune a tree, it is likely to help it or cause it to go into biennial bearing, which is a thing that happens fairly often on trees, especially neglected trees, and it's rather hard to correct, where you'll get a big crop of fruit every other year, and then of course every other year you'll get very little fruit to speak of at all. So good pruning of a tree helps good, consistent bearing of fruit from year to year. It allows the tree, what you're doing as you remove some of these limbs, the ones that cross and touch each other, it helps the health of the tree. You're not, the wind is not causing trees to rub and cause raw spots where insects and disease can get in. It helps the air circulation, so the fruit that is developing can actually be healthier and larger. And pruning is really important to having a good fruit crop.
Now, is it the same? Do you prune basically the same for all trees? I mean, is it? Are there any trees that you need to do it? Have a different procedure with when you're pruning them?
Oh, my experience is pretty much limited to primarily to apple trees. That's the ones I've had the most, and you know I can't say for sure on some of the others. I would say the cherries and the other than the shape, you prune a peach tree a little bit differently than you would an apple tree. But one of the important thing to do is try to remove any limb that's growing in towards the center of the tree, or any limbs, as I mentioned earlier, that are crossing another limb or touching that could cause a wind damage or scarring. And kind of take a look at the tree, get an idea for the general shape, and just open it up to where the air can circulate. I had an uncle who pruned trees quite a bit, and he sort of jokingly said that a bird should be able to fly through it, and not touch its wings, which is a little bit of a exaggeration. But what he was trying to say was to open it up and get it to where the air can circulate through there while the fruit's developing.
Very interesting. Colorado, now you have fruit trees, right?
I do. I do. I have two apple, two pear. I got a bunch of them.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. I can't remember all of them, but yeah, I've got.
Now, do you prune them?
I have not yet. They're still pretty young, so I haven't done much pruning on them.
Now, Charles, what about that? I mean, at what age do you start pruning them?
Right after I put them in the ground. Usually when they're shipped, or if you buy them from a nursery or whatever, there's usually one or two two of the limbs, the small limbs that are maybe broken or scarred. So I prune them back a little bit, and just shorten them up, shape them up a little bit, and that also helps them to get going and growing in the ground well. I think it sort of kicks them in gear a little bit.
Well, along those lines, now, this might seem like a stupid question, Charles. I mean, can you plant trees in the wintertime? I mean, if you're pruning them up and there's not a lot of sap, I mean, can you actually plant pre-pruned trees?
It'd be hard to find them to begin with. I wouldn't do it. Some folks like to plant them in the fall, early fall or mid, September, before the ground starts freezing. And some folks say that'll get them a little jump start into the next growing season. I haven't ever planted or set any out in the fall. I've always done it in the spring, and usually once the soil is starting to warm up a little bit, the nurseries are pretty good about, if you buy them from a mail order, they're pretty good about shipping them about the time you need them, just once early spring when you can get them going well. The nurseries, such as some of the places around commercially available in your area, they have them. They'll start getting them in just about any time. And here's coming up soon in our area. Obviously, we're in we're growing zone 6, so it varies from place to place in the country. But once they're available, just get them in the ground. And I can describe setting a tree out here a little bit too, in a little more detail, but. To kind of answer your question, I wouldn't plant one in the dead of winter, no.
Now the have you looked at one of the things that I was looking at with the fruit trees was this alternative way that they do what they do with their trimming, where they keep them super short and almost like on a truss system, and they're saying that they produce X amount. So much more fruit that way. Have you looked into that?
I have not, sir. I've never been really restricted on the space, and those are those trellis type trees are great, like for growing along a garden wall or something like that, or somewhere where you are tight for space. But I've never had that problem, so I don't have any experience with that at all.
Okay, Yeah, I've looked into it because I am tight for space, and I, you know, it seems kind of interesting, but at the same time, you know, I haven't been able to find a good track record locally of somebody that does it, so I'm a little nervous about trying to pull that off. But you know, the fruit trees are very interesting as far as the you know, the care for them, because I mean, it really doesn't take much. It doesn't seem like.
No.
You know, and at least for us, the fruit that we had, I mean, we had to take the fruit off because we were afraid that some of the branches were going to break, you know, just because it was the weight of the
fruit.
Oh, yes,
yes, in fact, that's one of the things. If you, once you do have good, healthy trees, they will set a good bunch of fruit, and it's very common to have to thin it. So, you know, you're concentrating, you may have a fruit cluster there with a center fruit that's called the king fruit, and then the rest of them around. You may have five or six or seven apples, for example, beginning to form in one bloom cluster. So some of those will probably need to be thinned, and that's you can do that mechanically. Some folks I've heard would just take a broom out and swat some of them off, and some of them remove them by hand. Some of them use chemical sprays to cause some fruit drop as well. And that method, you know, the method you choose is pretty well up to you.
Interesting.
But, yeah, if you remove a few of those fruits, usually try to leave that center fruit, that king fruit, and a few of the others around it. And by removing some of them, naturally you're reducing the competition and you're giving it more space, and you'll end up with better, bigger fruit.
Okay. Now, I'd like to shift focus a little bit, because this has been one of those things that I've always wanted to do, and I'm so close to just doing it because I'm tired of not doing it, but a greenhouse. Now, the area that I am so half tempted, because I have right now, I have garden boxes, and I measured the area, and it's a big area. It's like 30 by 40 area that I have all these raised beds in. And recently we laid gravel in that area, and it's all nice and neat. And I thought, man, it would be nice to just put a big greenhouse right over that whole thing so that I can extend my season out. Have you had much experience with greenhouses?
A little bit. On the Backwoods Home site, I did an article for them, and they have most of that article on their website. And it was in issue number 67. It described our greenhouse, has a photograph or two of it, the one we had. And it was simply attached, kind of coming off the side of our garage. And we used conduit, and it was kind of curved down into a wooden base. We had it had the plenty of space in there for starting plants and then for growing plants once they germinated. And it was attached to the side of the building so we could move some heat from the heated garage into the greenhouse there during the evenings and nights in the early spring. And we raised a lot of plants. We could use it late in the season for tomato plants to extend the growing season. I think we picked tomatoes, picked a tomato off on Christmas Eve one year that we kept going.
Nice.
So it's a good season extender. It's good for getting plants going, and you can always find a market for garden plants. If you've got extras, you can trade them, you can sell them, whatever you want to do with them.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, what plastic did you use on yours?
We used some stuff. It's woven. I recommend it highly. I've recommended it in writing and in my book and in the article here. It's from Northern Greenhouse Sales, and they're in it's Neche, N-E-C-H-E, North Dakota. And I'm not sure if they have a website, but the fabric, it's woven kind of like a blue woven tarp. I don't know if you're familiar with those, like you buy at Walmart or somewhere.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's kind of woven like that, only it's heavier and it's translucent, it's clear, basically. And it also has a really thin layer of UV-resistant film on either side, which helps it stand up to the sun's rays. It will last for for quite a few years. I think they recommend 3 or 4 years, but I've had some on there for 6 or 7 years at a time, and it's just outstanding stuff. I really like it.
Wow, nice.
And I have no interest in the business, but I just recommend it because I like it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm going to have to check that out myself because, you know, that's the other thing. I was looking at doing it in Conduent as well. But wanted to make sure that, you know, I got a plastic product that didn't, you know, that lasted longer than a year, you know.
Well, yes, the regular ordinary Visqueen construction plastic like you buy, you'll be lucky to last just a month or two. It just simply will not last.
Charles, do you live in an area that gets a lot of snow?
No, we you know, it varies. We're kind of in the slush belt, what I like to call. We get some snow, but we get a lot of rain, sleet, a little cold temperatures. But snow, we're not in the snow belt per se, I think.
Okay, I was just curious because I was just looking at your design and stuff, that kind of, and I just didn't know how something like that would hold up for like an average size snowfall.
It does pretty well. As you can see from the shape of it there, it's sloped enough to where it slides off fairly easy, sort of a semi-Quonset hut-looking thing there, and it did pretty well. We had a couple of good snows on it, and there was times that I went out and kind of pushed up on the plastic to get the snow off of it, but, you know, it held up well. It's well capable of supporting it if your ribs... The support structure will support it, and we had, like I say, conduit in there. We just bent it with a conduit bender that you can rent from a rental place if you don't have one, and it was inserted up at the top there. Along the top edge was a 2x4 that was bolted along the top of the wall, and a hole was bored in that to accept the conduit, and then the same way on the base at the bottom. It was just a 2x4 base, treated lumber everywhere, of course, and holes bored to accommodate the conduits.
Interesting. Now, the, you know, to do a conduit greenhouse, I'm sitting here trying to think, I'm trying to do the math here. To do a conduit, am I going to be having to worry about snow loads on that, if I build it too big, I assume?
It depends on how big you want to build it. You can see, I don't know if you have access to the article there, but ours was like 12 by 16, maybe. It wasn't huge.
Uh-huh.
But it was, we could grow a lot of stuff in there. I'd like to have a 100-foot one, but... Then it's turning from a hobby into a full-time job just about. It's going to take a lot of work. But snow loads, sure, it would be something you'd have to consider. If you're in snow country, certainly. And I don't know if that's something you could look up on the Internet, something to help you figure what you would need or not, you know, the spacing on the ribs and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I just hate to build that sucker and it collapse or first snowstorm or something, you know.
Yeah. Now, if I may, that fabric that I mentioned, they do have a website. It's called northerngreenhouse.com.
It is northerngreenhouse.com. All right.
Yes, sir. And like I say, I don't know the folks. I've never met them, but I just know that they have a good product, and I recommend it highly.
Okay. Yep, I'm on there now, taking a look here. So, okay, well, great. Now, the other thing is I think we talked about this a little bit last time. As far as getting ready for spring. Well, we didn't talk about this last time, but as far as getting ready for spring,
uh-huh.
You know, I imagine you have a compost bin. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Is there anything that I need to do with the compost,
this time of year, I'm just adding to it, you know, the kitchen scraps and once it starts warming up a little bit and I'm outside more, I'll give it a turn once in a while and kind of make sure things stay mixed up and just kind of keep an eye on it that way. One of the things I did do with mine, I built a large sieve or sifter using some half-inch hardware cloth, and that was attached to just a wooden frame that was probably 2 foot by 3 foot, and I could throw shovels full of that. You know, I'd put that sifter on my wheelbarrow and then throw shovels full of the compost in there and sift it out and then get the fine stuff and toss the big pieces, use it as mulch around one of the trees or something like that.
Nice.
But the compost itself, you know, it's just a continuous work in progress with the eggshells and the coffee grounds and the kitchen scraps and everything. And just as soon as you can, once it thaws out, everything's thawed out good. Just make sure it's all mixed up good.
Okay, well, so let's keep going along those lines, Charles. So
sure,
you know, I'm sure it's different in different, obviously, different temperate zones. I mean, when I was in Texas, we could keep our compost pile going year round.
Oh yeah.
But you know, up here in Iowa, you know, even though I'm throwing new stuff on there, it's below freezing most of the time, and it obviously nothing is breaking down at this point. So, and this is, I'll be
right.
Honest, this is my first winter doing this, and I've been hesitant probably the last month because the pile was getting so high with no breakdown. And I was, so
yeah.
I haven't been continuing to put stuff on there. So you're saying that it'll just naturally, when spring comes and it starts warming up, it'll naturally just start picking up the process all over again.
Yeah, yeah, and you can also, in the meantime, you can throw a little straw or something on top of it just to keep it covered up and, you know, just keep it stirred up, and you'll probably have the critters crawling around in a little bit if they have access to it. So, once things thaw out and warm up a little bit, it'll all go back to working, and, you know, you'll find out when you stir it up that there's earthworms in there, and it's a lively place again. It's just sort of dormant right now, I guess, or at least that's my experience with them.
Now, you have your compost and everything else. Do you spend any time prior to spring officially getting here doing anything special to prep, like your garden area or anything like that?
A little bit, right? You know, last fall, of course, I don't know if I've mentioned this in earlier conversations or not, but I like to mulch. I like to mulch heavily. Every year when we grow our garden, once everything's up and growing really well, I will give it a good tilling, a good hoeing around of plants and go through it with a tiller. And then we put down a layer of newspapers and then a thick layer of straw. And that helps us in a couple ways. It keeps down the weeds, of course, and then it also helps conserve the moisture. And last year that was really important in our area. It was a very dry year. But that, and then later, once the garden's harvested and I pull up the plants, all the straw that's left, the newspapers are fairly well broken down, so the straw that's left, I'll run through it with a tiller in the fall just to mix it up so this spring, once the soil warms up, I'll just go through it with a tiller and break up a spot and start that way. So right now, there's not a lot to do so far as the soil preparation. It's still just kind of freezing and thawing, and that helps to break down the soil and helps to break down the mulch bits and things like that. So it's just part of the process.
Okay. Earlier you had mentioned, you know, I think you had mentioned, like, we kind of caught you in the middle of it, you know, spraying and getting some certain things done. So I didn't know, like, this is my first season. I'm really
sure
going to be going after a larger, I've got 3 acres across the street. And last year I just kind of let it grow wild and just kept mowing it down, you know, to kind of let a little more of the grass come out as opposed to the weeds. And I just bought my first tractor,
Oh, great, great. Congratulations.
Thanks. You know, it took a year for me to figure out what I wanted to get. So, you know, and started getting my implements, and that's a whole nother conversation that we could probably have one day. It's, you know, what is the right blend of implements?
So that would be great. Be happy to do it.
But, and some of the, I've watched some of the farmers out here recently, that when it warmed up, when we got above freezing and everything kind of thawed just a little bit, they're out there with their their harrows or things like that, disking up the ground as it thaws. And I was like, well, don't you guys do that in the spring? And they say, well, we do it, you know, if you can get it done now, you do it now, and then you redo it in the spring. And so I didn't know if there was anything that you do or you recommend, especially for someone that's going to be planting the area for the first time.
Well, it's probably way too early to turn it. You know, once the ground falls, of course, if it's in sod or weeds or grass or whatever right now, you'd have to turn it and then allow it to dry a little bit and then disc it up. And, you know, you have to just get it worked up to where you can plant it. And I've found, and I don't suppose that you're going to be planning to use a lot of chemicals, so the first year you'll probably be doing a lot of cultivating and fighting with some weeds, but that will pay off in the long run, and just, you know, just have a good well-tilled garden without a lot of chemical sprays if that's the way you decide to go. But later, you know, once the soil warms up or once it dries out enough to get on it with a tractor and a plow, you'll probably want to break it up. Turn it with a regular turning plow, and as I say, after that you'd want to disc it, and then after that dries out, you probably go over it with a harrow to smooth it and level it, and then it'd be more ready for planting.
Yeah, and basically what I'm doing is I've got two different sections. I'm putting up a garden in one, which is completely different, but our goal this year is to go out there, break up this ground, throw down some clover and other some local natural grasses, and maybe mix in the seeds some of the natural wildflower seeds up here. We want to get our a couple of our beehives going on the far end of the property, then you know, beginning of summer, getting a couple of nanny goats to start out there, I'm fencing in the whole 3 acres, so that way they can go out there and free range and or I guess it's not necessarily free range if it's fence, but they have a much larger area to work through there.
Yeah, that sounds great. and I've even heard of people taking an area and fencing it and turning hogs in on it and just allow them to root it up, and basically they plow it up for you. If you want to do that, I don't know what kind of situation you're in, but. That's a possibility as well, too. Sort of low technology, but it gets the job done.
Yeah, that would actually be interesting. We've got a lot of hog farms here in Iowa, so I don't think any of the neighbors would mind. But I don't know if I'd want to be taking care of hogs. So, okay, so, I mean, other things for, let's stick with the garden theme for a few more minutes. Yeah, what other things can you recommend that people can kind of get a jump start on?
Okay, you mentioned spray, and what I was referring to was back in the orchard. Okay, we're pruning our trees, and I will mention this. I didn't yet, but I did mention taking out those limbs that grow inward, taking out the limbs that touch each other across. And when you prune your trees, we do what called pruning to an outside bud, and that promotes the outward growth. To keep the tree open and help it to have a good open shape, and that helps a lot. Now the spraying part in the early spring is usually a dormant oil spray, and that's just it's an orchard oil that's just a very high viscous oil, and what it does, it coats and smothers insects that might be under a piece of bark, or, you know, scaling insects, that kind of thing, and That's a very good thing to do for your fruit trees in the early spring.
Now, how
you can get,
go ahead, sir.
Go ahead. You can get dormant oil at any garden supply. They're familiar with it and can help you with, you know, the application of it or the directions on it.
Well, and that was my question. I wasn't quite sure exactly what it was. Is it a natural product?
It's very common, and it's I think it would probably be accepted in organic practice. I'd have to check on that, but it's very common, and it's not like it's a harsh chemical or anything like that. It's just a very high viscous oil.
Okay. Now I have to ask you, and I can't remember from our last conversations I remember we kind of asked you quite a few questions last time about the article you wrote back in 2004 on beekeeping basics. Did you ever? Are you back to keeping bees, or have you gotten back into it?
I am not, and it's something that I just haven't had the opportunity to get back into. Something I'd still like to do. I'm going to be retiring from my full-time job at the end of June, and then there's several of those things I'd like to get back into, and that's one of them.
Now, how difficult is it to keep? You know, we wanted to get started, and like I said, we're planting this year, and a couple of the people we've talked to around here said, now is the time for us to start getting ready for it by plotting out where we're going to keep things, getting our bee boxes together, things, you know, all kinds of different things that we need to kind of get ready for. Because the spring's, when spring hits, the bees really get active.
This is a good time. I'm sorry, go ahead. I'll cut you off.
No, that's okay. And I was just going to say, you know, what was your experience with that? And A and B, I don't know how long you kept your first set. How hard are they to maintain or keep through the winter? Or do you basically start from scratch every year?
No, I did not. I wintered them over. Ideally, this time of year is a good time to be out in the shop putting the bee boxes together if you buy the wooden ones. A lot of folks are opting for the plastic ones now, which are very good. But my experience is with the wooden ones, so you get those and get them put together and get them painted and get them ready to go. You get your frames and your foundation and get it all ready to go as well. And then, you know, once things start happening in the spring, if you order your bees, you know, my experience with ordering bees is that the post office will call you bright and early when they come in. I mean, they don't want them sitting around in the post office in a box longer than they have to. The package bees are not difficult to install. They come with directions on how to do it properly, but basically you make sure you find the queen and get it situated, and then you shake the other bees out in front of the beehive, and then they just go trooping in to find the queen. And it's a pretty neat process to actually do. Bees are very interesting to work with and to watch, and they're just kind of neat to have around in addition to the honey. Now, so far as overwintering in our area, the main thing that we have to do in our area is to make sure we put an opening restrictor down there, to keep mice out, because mice will get in there and take up residence. And it also restricts the airflow where it doesn't get quite as cold. You know, just there's a small opening for the bees to get in and out to make cleansing flights when the weather warms up enough when they can get out a little bit. But other than that, it restricts the airflow, basically. And the second thing is to be sure and leave enough honey in the hive after you harvest your honey crop to they have enough to overwinter on.
Ah, see, I wouldn't even have thought of that. That makes sense, because that is what they eat. Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, out of curiosity, why did you stop doing it?
Well, the last bees that I had, they got the tracheal mites or the varroa mites one, but the parasites got them, and I just at that point I thought, well, I'm not at a place right then where I want to get started back into it again, so I didn't order any more bees at that time, You know, it's something I'd have to deal with again. I'm in a little different area. I'm about 20 miles west of that location now, so I don't know. I know some of my neighbors, a couple of them have beehives, and they seem to be doing okay. So, you know, I'd be ready to try it again.
Yeah, I haven't really been worried about the mites because I don't know enough about it yet to be concerned. As Colorado Ron can testify, I usually know enough to be dangerous.
That's true.
I understand.
And know enough to cost me three times as much money as I probably need to spend.
We must be related.
So, you know, I figure that I'll go out there and spend the money, you know, getting this, and I probably could have bought, you know, a ton of honey for what I spent on getting my first two sets of bees going, and then, you know, we'll go from there.
Well, the one thing I have noticed is that honey prices are really high now. I mean, I of course, I haven't bought honey for many years, but I know we used to. I'm still have a couple of jars left from the last honey I took off, but that's been a few years, and probably 20 years ago we used to sell honey for probably $60 for a 5-gallon jug full, and you know that wouldn't get close to it now.
No. Yeah, that's really cheap nowadays.
So,
yeah.
So Charles, I have to ask you. This is kind of off a part of this theme, but I have to mm-hmm. figure, being a law enforcement officer, you know, that this
uh-huh.
is something that you'd probably be very familiar with. You know, people think of, you know, the end of winter, getting prepared for spring, you know, looking at things like what we're talking about, the chores and things you can get done there. But I was thinking today, this is actually also the time you really want to start cleaning and re-weathering your weapons that you used from, you know, the season of hunting and everything else, and making sure they're ready. Because most people aren't going to be touching them again, you know, until next hunting season. And believe me, I know from screwing up and not cleaning my, you know, my black powder rifle well enough at the end of the season, and you could go the next season and there's, you know, it's rusty and you got to spend hours and hours and hours cleaning it out. And so, you know, do you do that? I mean, do you spend a little time? I don't even know if you hunt anymore, but do you? Do you spend time kind of going through at the end of your season and just going back and rehitting all your weapons and touching them up before you put them away for the season?
Well, that's a good point. That's you know, I like firearms a lot, and that's kind of a strong area of interest for me. And as far as the hunting weapons go, hopefully we wipe them down you know, dry them off, make sure they're not wet from when we come in from hunting each time. But yeah, it's good. That's something that's good to sit around the stove and, you know, and sit around the house in the evenings in the winter time and take the guns, take your firearms, and, you know, maybe strip them down, a little farther than you normally might, and make sure everything's working properly, good, clean, no rust, pockets have got, you know, started anywhere. Just kind of a general maintenance on them, and that's a good thing to do on a winter evening when you're sitting around them. I always try to keep one or two firearms available to grab in case of, you know, something tries to get a chicken or a dog's making off with someone or a coyote comes in or something like that. So we try to keep one or two firearms available at all times anyway. But, you know, some of the hunting firearms we do give a little more extra attention to. It's good familiarization to know how they work and the intricacies of them and that kind of thing. And then it's just good to keep them cleaned and oiled and in good condition. They'll last for generations that way.
Right. Now, out of curiosity, do you prefer any one type of oil over another? I mean, I was out at the local gun store recently, and it just seems like there are so many different products out now. I mean,
yes, yeah.
I mean, you know, when I was a kid and when I was growing up, it was like you went out there, you had your solvent, you went out there, you cleaned it, you ran a couple patches through, you ran your hard brush through, and then my grandfather, make sure you put a good coat of, you know, gun oil on it. But you don't see just gun oil anymore. It's like silicone this, you know. Graphite,
yeah.
That, blah, blah, blah. And I'm looking at this stuff, and I'm like, holy cow. I mean, how do you know what works better for, you know, especially for me? I want to make sure my stuff, I've got more guns than I fire per year. You know, I kind of do it in rotation.
Good.
It's like
good.
This year I'm using the 30-30. Next year it might be the 30-06. Next year it's 270 Win Mag. It all depends on what you're hunting.
Great.
So some of them are being put away for longer periods of time than others. One might not get touched for, you know, almost 2 years before I'm going out there and taking it out and siding it in again because I'm going to use it that season. I mean, is gun oil still the best tried and true method to do it, or are some of these newer fangled silicone and graphite, protective materials better?
Well, in my opinion and in my experience, you know, the old gun oil that we put a few drops on a rag and wiped everything down with, it sure worked awfully well. And back when I was a kid, that's what we had. That was before the days of aerosol oil sprays of different varieties. I won't mention any brand names right now, but that's all we had. I mean, you would, like you say, you would use some bore cleaner and clean out the bore really well, and run a dry patch through, and then you'd put an oily patch through it to put a little coating of oil on the inside just to keep things oiled up a little bit. And then the same thing, you would wipe down any metal surfaces that you could find. You'd wipe it down with just an oily rag and just a light coat of protectant. The old gun oils that used to come with the gun cleaning kits worked fine. There are some good products out there. There's several that, you know, I've taken in my work. I've had several firearms courses and some armorers courses and things, and there are some products that are recommended that are really good, but just good old low-end can of a bottle of gun oil is very good and should be on everybody's shelf, I would say.
Yeah, okay, so I'm glad you say that because, you know, as I've gone to a lot of gun shows recently, and I think everybody and their mother's going to gun shows because there's this scare of it. Yeah,
everybody's there.
guns aren't going to exist by the end of the year, but and it's kind of funny. I was just this morning, I decided to stop by a local sporting goods store, and I walked into the gun section, and I felt sorry. There was six associates that usually work that area. You know, one works shotguns, one works, you know, hunting rifles, one works black powder, and a couple that work pistols, and then one that works the antique weapons. You know, it's kind of like a Bass Pro or Cabela's. They have their consignment area, and all these guys were just sitting there, you know, sit there twiddling their thumbs because there was not in that 30,000 square foot area more than like three guns in the entire area. I mean,
Wow. Every
pistol was completely sold out. And I walked up to the pistol guy, and he goes, yeah, we haven't had anything in probably a week. Just like, well, how are you guys keeping your jobs? And he's like, well, I mean, you get five in, and, you know, and there must have been 10 people there at open going, you know, they walk in. Apparently they come every day looking to see if they have ammo, magazines, or guns. And I'm just like, wow.
So. And I think that's similar all over the country right now. I believe I know my son and his father-in-law waited for about 3 hours to get into the gun show at Indianapolis here a few weeks ago, and it was just a madhouse for 2 days.
That's just, you know, and the prices have gotten so outrageous. In your career, have you ever remembered a time that's been like this?
Not as bad as this. I can say that historically, you know, back when the first assault weapons ban went through, and there, you know, we have magazines that back then, I think they're stamped on the magazines, restricted to law enforcement or military use and things like that. And at this point, they're available to anyone, the same ones after the assault weapons ban had been rescinded. But, you know, who knows what the future holds, and that I think that's what's got everyone motivated to try to get the firearms they want now while they can. Unfortunately, there's people that are, you know, it's kind of a market-driven or a supply-demand-driven thing, and there's a lot of panic buying going on. There's folks taking advantage of that. I know of a few gun sellers who are refusing to jack up their prices because of the panic buying, and they're selling them for very, you know, similar price, profit margin to what they were before. They may have to pay a little bit more for them themselves, but they're not really gouging the public for them, I guess that was what I wanted to say.
Yeah, and that's good. And that's rare. I'll give a plug out to, there's a chain called Gander Mountain, and they have refused to raise their prices at all, so all their magazines, all their ammo, and all their handguns are still at the same price as they were, you know, prior to this all happening.
Well, that's great. That's great.
And so, yeah, I'll pop in there occasionally and check it out. But unfortunately, you know, there's people like I was there this last week, and they got 50 clips in for AR-15s, and one guy bought all 50. You know, and he's basically,
wow.
And we asked, and I asked him, I said, wow, is that really how many you wanted? And he's like, oh, I resell them at the gun shows. I can make twice as much. Yeah, you know, so I was like, well, at least he's honest about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, out of curiosity, and if you don't want to answer this, I completely understand, but as a law enforcement officer, what's your take on things like the limiting the capacity of magazines?
Personally, it's not going to help anything. It's not a firearms problem. It's not a magazine problem. I could get really philosophical about it. I think it's a cultural problem, and I think there's a lot of issues, a lot of underlying things that are involved. But it's certainly not a firearms problem. That's simply. Just a method of it's an excuse to help gain control of the supply of firearms in the country, in my opinion.
Now, do you I think Colorado Ron and I believe or completely agree with you. Do you think that most officers think would agree with you? I mean almost every law enforcement officer that I've talked to up to this point has basically said that this is not a smart move. It doesn't help them any because, anybody that they're going to be dealing with probably isn't following the rules and getting the guns legally anyway. So you're really not helping out law enforcement by doing this.
Right. And in fact, on the contrary, I view, of course, I'm in a rural area. If I lived in downtown Chicago or downtown Detroit, I might have different thoughts about it. And I think that is where some of the support for firearms restrictions are coming from in the law enforcement community, Los Angeles, someplace like that. I think, and this is strictly my opinion, that law enforcement officers in rural areas are big supporters of the Second Amendment. And I think that folks in those rural areas support law enforcement. I think that they kind of, I know there's places I could go that I could fully expect if I got in a bad situation, there might be a citizen show up with a firearm there that kind of have my back.
Yeah, it's the same way where I live. I mean, it's, you ask our sheriff and things like that, and he'd say, most of the time he'd rather have these people armed because they're more likely to help them than cause problems. So
yeah, and they're just by and large, you get your exceptions. I mean, we have drug problems in the country. We've got meth tweakers, and we've got problems. But by and large, the throughout America, the citizenry, the firearms owners are good, solid, hard-working, good moral people, and hard-working, good moral people help one another, and that extends out into to helping law enforcement too when need be.
Great. All right, Charles, we've got four more minutes before we have to go. Can you give us one more good Charles Sanders tip on things that people can do to get prepared for spring before spring gets here?
Oh boy! Get through those seed catalogs. You probably start getting them around Halloween time. Seems like they come earlier in the mail every year. But get your seeds ordered. Start getting your containers gathered up to set your seeds in. We use styrofoam cups. We use yogurt cups and egg cartons and everything else. Get those seeds started. Remember to have some good bottom heat to get the seeds germinated. And it's a good time to consider using a little bit of a cold frame to get some early spinach and lettuce and radishes and stuff going out in the garden. So those are all things you can do to help get a jump on the gardening season for sure.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Charles, and it was great finally talking to you again.
Sorry it took so long this time, but I look forward to speaking with you again, and feel free to call anytime.
I may hit you up here real soon and we might do a short episode on tractors and the things you need to get when you buy one.
Okay, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you very much, Charles.
You guys take care.
All right, you too.
See ya.
Bye.
All right, guys, that was Charles Sanders. He is a author, or a regular contributor for Backwoods Home Magazine. I always like talking to Charles. He's just a real down-to-earth guy.
He is. But, you know, everybody likes to talk to the just down-to-earth common man, so to speak, blue-collar worker.
Yep, I agree. I wish I was more like that.
You are. You are.
I'm totally not. I'm definitely not. I mean, I'm probably more down to earth than more executive types, but I'm definitely not Charles Sanders type of down to earth. Maybe Colonel Sanders. I might be Colonel Sanders type of down to earth. Yeah.
All right. I'm not going to argue with it.
I can walk around with a bucket of chicken with the best of them. Yeah. That's it. All right, we should take our final commercial break, and when we come back, let's go ahead and have a quick chat about the car purchasing thing. We need to get our Homestead Hunters done, and there's a third thing, but it's completely not hitting me right now, so we'll find out when we come back. Homestead Hunter. We'll talk about the cars, and I'll figure out what the third thing was I wanted to make sure we hit. So, guys, we'll talk to you right after this commercial break.
Hi, this is Jay Steven Stoller for Backwoods Home Magazine. If you like the program you're listening to right now, consider subscribing to Backwoods Home Magazine. Call 1-800-835-2418 or go to www.backwoodshome.com and click on the subscribe button. Every issue of Backwoods Home Magazine is over 100 pages, packed with solid self-reliance advice by experts who tell you how to survive in these unpredictable times. Call 1-800-835-2418.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Company Computer Guy.
Mr. Company Computer Guy.
You are the ruler of the RAM, the guru of the gigabyte. The monster of the memory.
Show me the way.
When we screw up the boot up, you are there. Without you, computers would megabyte.
Megabyte.
The countless hours we spend surfing the internet and accidentally stumbling upon porn sites would instead be spent working.
Working for the man.
So crack open a nice cold Bud Light, Mr. Company Computer Guy. For it's you who keeps our logons logging and our hard drives hard.
You gotta see this porn time.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
All right, well, you are back with Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci, and this is Self-Reliance Exposed, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine, the only magazine that's backwards. No, that just totally kidding about that. No, that's not right. No. Backwoods Home Magazine is...
Dave, that wasn't me, magazine. Dave.
All right, let's go ahead and hit this up. Let's start with our Homestead Hunter before we get into the other stuff, because sometimes we get really, really, really tied up on these, and then we eat up a lot of time.
Yeah.
So, all right, this Homestead Hunter that you sent out this week, which will be on facebook.com/ColoradoRon page...
Yep.
Is in Idaho.
Idaho.
I love places in Idaho.
Yep. I like Idaho a lot, and so I thought, you know, why not look up there again and see what I could find, and I ran across this one. I really like this one. This is this time I decided, you know, last time or at least the last couple of them, I've been way under the $150,000 range. Again, if you guys aren't familiar with it, it's $150,000, has to have at least a couple of acres, 3-bedroom, 2-bath home. And so I found this one. It's in McCammon, Idaho, but it's not very far from Pocatello. It's just right down the road from Pocatello. So it's a pretty good spot. You know, you're close to Salt Lake. You're only, you know, a couple hours drive from Salt Lake. you know, this one is 149, but what I liked about this one, for me anyway, it was 3,500 square feet.
It's huge.
Big home. So it's kind of a raised ranch, I believe it's brick, if I remember right.
It's brick externally, yeah.
Yep, external brick. And the home just has so much room. What was the land? I forgot to look. Oh, that was the other thing I liked. It has a 30 by 50 shop down by the main road. So you have a long driveway that goes up to the house, but down by the main road, you have a shop down there. So that's pretty handy, especially for you wrench turners and do-it-yourselfers. Being able to have that down there, you can actually run a business out of this facility pretty easily. It's 226. What does that break down to? It's 40,000 square feet per acre. And this is 226,000 square feet. So I can't remember. What is that, 5 acres? I think it's 5 acres. So it's just over 5 acres. 4-bedroom, 2-bath. Again, 3,500 square feet. What do you think? What's your take on it?
I think that I liked almost everything on it. And I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I was reading something when you were doing it. So it's okay. So it's 4-bedroom, 2-bath. Awesome, good place. That's a lot of place to start. 3,500, almost 3,600 square feet. Huge. The inside with it, if I remember correctly, it actually has. It looked like it had an upstairs and a downstairs fireplace.
Yeah, I believe. Yes.
So I think that's really cool. I wasn't all that hip on the kitchen.
The kitchen's
really small.
I was really disappointed in the kitchen, and if I had that place, that would be the first thing my wife would make me tear out and redo.
The way your kitchen's set up now, Heather would not be happy with this. But, I mean, it looks like it could have a lot of space. It was just not utilized well.
Yeah.
So I think that there's definitely potential there.
It's a typical 1981. You know, it was built in 81, so it's an 81 galley kitchen is basically what it is.
Yeah. What I don't like about it is I don't necessarily like the location that it's on. It's definitely on a very dry bedrock sort of Idaho environment. Now, it's funny, directly across the street, maybe 200 yards, there is a river or a lake or a creek that runs through it. And you can definitely see where the creek runs through, tons and tons and tons of green grass, and then everything surrounding it's very dry.
Yeah, if you look, you've got a seasonal stream, it looks like, that comes down right into the property.
Off the back end, right. But my guess was that was probably more of an overflow.
Yeah, but here's what I liked about it. If you zoom way out, you are technically surrounded by National Forest. Bonneville Park, I believe, is what it's called. Bonneville Peak.
It's the Caribou National Forest.
There it is. Caribou National Forest. Yeah. So you got that on the backside, and when I looked at it pretty close, it looks like it's almost a straight shot, and there's not really anything in between. You are the last road between there and there. So even though your land is not connected, you could easily jump on a horse and ride right into the Caribou National Forest.
No, that's awesome. And, you know, the taxes are decent, $1,000 a year in the taxes. I love the shop.
Yeah.
I mean, the shop is awesome.
Yeah, big shop.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a winner. I mean, at $149,000, and it's, let me see, it's 226,000 square feet on the lot. Did you say how big that was? That's what, 4.5? No, it's over 5 acres, right?
Uh-huh. Just
okay.
Over.
Yeah, so that's a plenty big piece of property. That's nice. So this was a good find, Colorado. I mean, it's external brick. The only thing I really couldn't tell, and I think it's a tin roof, but I can never see in a picture good enough to actually see what the roof is.
I was thinking the same thing. It was really hard to tell. there was no good shots of it. Even from the aerial shot, it was really hard to tell. So I'm not sure. That's something I'd have to ask.
Yeah, and because the materials, when you look at the what it says roof type other. So I have no idea, you know, what it is. Looking at the edges of it, my guess is it's probably a metal roof, but that's fine. I think that's a. Anyway, if you get a chance. Oh, and it looks like it's a 2-car garage, and they don't mention that.
Yeah, it's got a 2-car garage in the house. You know, not in, you know
it,
that doesn't.
It's attached, not detached.
Yeah, yep, attached. So no, it's nice, and if you zoom in as close as you can, I mean there are quite a bit of trees on the south side of that house, a lot of trees and a lot of shrubbery, and so you do. It does look like you get a fair amount of water there in order to get that much tree. That's quite a bit of. Green there.
Yeah, I was just looking at the terrain all around.
Yeah, oh, I agree. I agree.
My few experiences in Idaho have been with friends that have property there, and trying to dig that hard rock up, it's horrible.
Yep.
But when, I mean, if you can get a garden going, get the stuff going, then once you get it going, it's fine.
I would a greenhouse. That's the only way I'd do it there is raised beds and greenhouses.
Yeah, I think that would probably make the most sense.
Yep.
in getting things done. Okay. Well, good pick. So again, you'll be able to find this link on Facebook/ Colorado Ron page if you want to take a look at this place.
Yep.
And we'll kind of go. I think this was better than last week's.
Yeah, I think so. I really like it. It's a nice spot. Again, it's really close to everything. You know, you can do some serious shopping in Salt Lake. I mean, everything you want there is there. And pretty much, you know, about 95% of what you want is in Pocatello, which is 5 minutes down the road. So
cool. All right. I remembered what the other thing I wanted to kind of talk about briefly.
Okay.
So if for those of you who have been listening for a while and those of you who haven't, you know, about back in – September of this last year, I found out that I was diabetic.
Yep.
And I mean, and my A1Cs when I got tested was at 14, which mean my estimated average blood glucose was like 360. It was way up there. and they said, we have to put you on insulin now. And you're going to be insulin dependent forever and everything else. And I decided that I wasn't going to do it. Hold on a second. Excuse me. And decided that I was going to change my diet and kind of go at it from a different avenue. Well, I just had my A1C done last week, and it came back. And I went from a 14, which is a 360, down to a 6, which is pre-diabetic.
Nice.
Yeah, so through eating better and everything else, I'm still on the pills and everything else, but right now they're saying that insulin doesn't even look in my future history if I can keep it like this.
That's great. That is really good. Good for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just wanted to share that because it goes to show you that, you know, you don't have to rely on these medicines. It's the easy way out for the government and for the doctors to do things to you. Once they get you on it, you're dependent. You can't ever get off of it. And I mean, I had to make a lot of sacrifices on how I ate and what I ate and everything else. But you know, here we are, you know, 6 months down the road, and I walked in there and met with the doctor, and she was like, "You're not going to believe this, but you know, you're considered pre-diabetic now, and you don't, you know, since you never have been on insulin, you know, if you can keep it like this, you'll never be."
That is awesome. Good for you.
Yeah, so I'm pretty stoked about it. I mean, I'm still at levels, and you know, it still pops up occasionally. I still got to take my morning pills and things like that. But I'm glad that at this point, you know, I'm not going to have to be giving myself injections on a regular basis. So if I can do it as crappily as I ate and with my lifestyle, anybody can do it.
Yeah, it just changed. It's just a matter of changing the diet, I believe. So. I'm a firm believer. I wish my dad would do that. Instead, he just keeps poking himself with that needle.
Yeah. Now, on that vein, how is you were doing a pretty aggressive paleo diet? We talked about this in end of December and early January. Where are you with your
home? You know, that's very interesting. I walk now probably 3-4 times more, further than I ever have before. I'm in really good shape as far as that goes. I work out. I ride the bike, and I've noticed I can go a ton further than I ever was able to before. I feel a lot better. I have a lot more energy. I think a lot clearer. But I haven't lost any weight.
None.
Not a pound.
So why do you think that is?
I have no idea. I'm just kind of getting fed up with it, but I have no idea. But it's really kind of weird. I don't understand it. I mean, I can pretty much outwork and outrock and outrun and do just about anything that anybody else can do. But for some reason, I can't lose the weight. So, but it's really weird.
Yeah, that's odd. But I mean, everybody's a little bit different. Maybe you've lost as much of the weight as you're going to do, and it's all muscle at this point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
Hey, come on. I'm trying to give you an out here.
No, that's not the case.
All right.
No, so I got to figure that out. But, yeah, that's the only thing. But, yeah, I got plenty of energy. I feel great, but I'm just not losing it.
Okay. All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're looking for in your car, and then I'll tell my car story.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking for something. Here's going to be my next goal, and I'm going to see if I can achieve this. I think I can, but I want a road trip vehicle. I want something that I can show up to a meeting in that does, that's not embarrassing. I want it can't be like Bubba's truck where you got to hide it around the building when you show up. You know what I mean? So it's got to be decent looking, and it's got to be something 20 miles to the gallon, and it's got to it's got to be able to go to the distance. I want it to be able to go, I want to be able to go all the way, 3-4 days drive. And not have any issues. But the main thing is, like I said, it's got 20 miles to the gallon is the minimum. So I've been looking at several different cars, several different options. And I'm kind of enjoying looking at some of the wagons, the wagon versions of some of these cars, just because of the fact that you can lay that back seat down and have a ton of room, whether it's just me riding solo. All the other requirement is it's got to seat 4 adults pretty comfortably. So my kids usually ride with me to the expo. My father does, things like that. So, it's got to seat everybody, and I want to be able to do it and do this for under $3,000. So I think it's doable. I just got to figure it out and find the right ride. So the vehicles I'm looking at right now, obviously are, there's a couple of them that I've kind of gone back and forth on. I had a Suburban one time that got like 17 miles a gallon. And so that's pretty close, but it's just not close enough. I also had a Honda that got 35 miles a gallon. So, that's almost double. And when you're driving, 1,000 miles or so, I mean, that starts to add up. And so I don't want to, the vehicle that I drive, I don't want it to have such little creature comforts that it's not enjoyable to drive 1,000 miles. I've been looking at like Buicks and things like that. And, like I said, it would be handy if it was the wagon version just so that I could, lay that back seat down when nobody's with me or, I can jump in the back and catch a couple hours snooze before I jump back on the road.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm going to be driving back and forth to Michigan a lot. But I don't know if I could afford to do it at 20 miles a gallon. I've been looking for things up in the 30.
Oh, range. I know. If you're looking at new cars, I'm telling you, man, I've looked at some of those new cars, and you cannot beat the new Ford cars.
Actually, I was looking at Chevy. Mm-hmm. The Chevy Cruze gets 38 miles to the gallon.
Yep.
And it's a decent-sized car. But I have to share my experience, and this is kind of a warning to people that are out there and everything else. So I was looking at a Chevy Cruze, and I am just morally opposed to buying a brand-new car.
Yeah.
for the simple reason that the second you drive it off the lot, it loses so much of its value. And so the closest I'll come to a new car is the previous year. And so I was at the car dealer looking at purchasing a new car, and I went through the whole process, and we had found one, and I was getting ready to leave in it, and they had told me it had been a fleet car. And I was like, okay, well, that's not a big deal. It was a 2012 Cruze, and it had 5,000 miles on it. And I was like, insignificant, that's fine, no big deal. And after we had done all the paperwork, we come to find out that all the features that they had listed on the car, not all of them, a lot of them didn't actually exist in the car. Because when it's a fleet car, the whoever orders the fleet cars has the ability to pull options out, and they don't have to, and they don't notify them when they sell them back to the dealers what these things are. And so, you know, this thing was, you know, it was supposed to have simple things like, you know, USB ports to go ahead and plug things in for your radio, and electric seat, you know, things like that for the electric window or mirrors and all this other stuff. And all those things were missing. Cigarette lighters, you know, so you could plug something like your 12-volt cigarette lighter adapters inside there. They had taken those out of the car, so there was no place to plug anything in. The biggest thing was they can actually have, get this, the airbags taken out.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And so, you know, that was just like, you got to be kidding me. You know, they take these things out, and then we purchased the car, and luckily I'd only driven about 6, maybe 8 miles away before I started looking and seeing, well, that's missing. Well, that's missing. And these were things I didn't even look at because they're considered standard features on the car.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, well, you know, I wasn't going to look for a cigarette lighter so I could plug my stuff in, because it's just like, you know, it's a standard feature. It says it on the sheet. It's going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm driving down the road and I want to plug in my phone, and all of a sudden, where's the cigarette lighter? Where's the cigarette thing? And it's not there. So I'm like, okay, you know something? Maybe they don't have it in this model. Maybe it, even though it says it here, maybe you have to plug it into the USB port. So I go to look for that, and it's like, oh, that's not there. And then you start going down the list and things are missing. So the big thing was the dealer had the audacity, you know, to sit there and say that. So they were like, oh, we're sorry. You know, yeah, this happens sometimes. I go, you know, you guys could be sued. You know, you're selling products. It's up on your website, and it's on the sheet, and it's even in the contract that it has all these features, and it doesn't. And I go, that's, you know, that's not good. And they're like, well, you know, we didn't do it intentionally. It happens sometimes. It happens actually monthly when we get these cars in. You know, sometimes we don't catch these things. I'm like, that's bad. So they go, we'll give you here's another car that's similar, and it had 15,000 more miles on it. It was a base model, so it didn't even have the same features that the other one did, and they wanted to sell it to me for the same price.
Oh, jeez.
And when I said no, the salesperson actually had the audacity to say, well, this sucks now because I've just wasted my entire day with you and I didn't make a commission.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me.
Oh, I was just like, hold on. I wasted my whole day. I bought a car, and it didn't even have what you would put on the internet and on the forums that it actually had. So if anybody should be ticked, I should be ticked. But now you're telling me that I wasted your entire day and you didn't make a commission? I was done. So Chevy, you just lost a customer just because of your dealership.
You know what? And I hate to call this out, but I will not buy Chevy or Dodge simply because of the bailout. And, you know, the fact that Ford didn't take the bailout, and the fact that Ford really has stepped up in their cars. You know, the last vehicle I rented when I was in Salt Lake was a Ford, and the time before that I rented a Chevy, and the time before that I rented a Ford. And let me tell you, it really is night and day. Go and test drive a new Ford or a newer Ford, and you will be pleasantly surprised. It really is night and day difference. I was just extremely shocked at the build quality of Chevy versus Ford.
Well, I'll have to go out and look at them. Well, it's obvious I'm not going back to Chevy.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I mean, even that Chevy as a apparently that's just a standard principle of theirs, is to sell these fleet cars and then to send them to the dealers and have them sell them out, and not notify people that they that the options have been removed out. Is a horrible way to do a business.
Oh, totally.
And,
totally.
Yeah, so I was at my wit's end with that. So
yeah, I think you should look at a Ford Fusion. Ford Fusion would be a good fit for you, and that's right about the same as the Cruise, but it's got the MySync, so it'll sync to your phones. It's got all the USB plugins. It's got 35 miles to the gallon or something like that. I think Ford Fusion might fit your bill.
All right, I'll have to go look at a Fusion. Well, I thought Fusions were hybrids. I can't buy a hybrid.
No, it's not a hybrid.
Okay. Then maybe we can work it out. For some reason I thought all the I could have swore all Fusions were hybrids. The day I drive around in a hybrid I'm pretty much done.
just throw me away. I'm done.
I just can't get at that point I'll admit that there's global warming and we should all be singing Kumbaya. Hopefully it just never happens.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
All right. Well, on that note, we should go ahead and get going.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and run through everything. Guys, if you want to check out Backwoods Home Magazine, and I really, really suggest that you do, you can go to www.backwoodshome.com to check out what's going on with the Self-Reliance Expo, www.selfrelianceexpo.com. Colorado, your Facebook page is
facebook.com/ Colorado Ron Page.
Okay, and you can check out Self-Reliance Expo using / Self-Reliance Expo, Backwoods Home / Backwoods Home Mag, and Bubba Da Vinci at / Bubba Da Vinci. That's it this week. We'll talk to you next week with more tips and tricks on how to get prepared for spring. And as always, take care of yourself and hope you guys have a good week. You guys,
perfect.
All right, take care, Colorado.
See ya.
We're from North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks